Things were different then, he said. Of course they were. The many ages are always different. I was somehow forgetting my fear. The debate had reignited something within me. Love of an argument, perhaps. But how can the throne world remain safe if its fortress worlds fall one by one? I hear the entreaties from those we send out into the void. One of them, a fine man who is almost certainly dead now, said that we can no longer afford our old laws. He's looked the enemy in the eye. I'd trust his judgment. I was getting carried away then, and I recognized it immediately. The Captain General remained impassive. I doubt I could have done anything to seriously discomfort him. I was so far below him in the scale of majesty that I was lucky he even deigned to talk at all. You may be right, Chancellor, he said evenly. Everything you say may be right, and yet it is all irrelevant. Wars and tactics are for our generals. For me, they are nothing. A thousand worlds might fall, and still it would be nothing. You understand this? Only one thing would compel me to change the ancient law that governs us. If it were his manifest will. I hesitated, unsure what to make of that. How do you... That is the task of our lives to unravel. There was something exhausting about talking to one with such unbreakable certainty. They had to be that way, no doubt, but I was used to the world of politics, where the art of the possible was all, and a person might believe one thing in the morning and another by dusk, and so it was hard to engage with. The High Lords will discuss it anyway, I said, clutching at what I could. Yes, said Valoris. Your doing, I understand, only partly. I looked him directly in the eye as closely as I could bear to. If you're not there, they'll debate these issues without full understanding. They're currently divided, but that might change. I've known it before. Suppose they vote to withdraw the law. What then? You'll be a part of this war, whether you like it or not. None may compel us. Maybe not. But the vote would create division. Now, when we really don't need any more of it. I felt myself warming to the theme, and some of my confidence returned. This is the issue, Captain General. You have control. You can end this for a generation if you choose. If you're so sure of your stance, come to the Council. You can take Brack's seat. You can say what you've said here to me, and none could gainsay you. Is that not worth it? He was studying me. Just then, I saw what he had been doing. My words made no difference at all, and it had always been the utmost hubris to think they might do. But he was interested in me. Why does this drive you so much, Chancellor? He asked. My duty is to serve. Impartially. And yet you are so desperate to see the motion pass. I floundered a little. I wish to see the war won. Surely all of us do. Valoris drew closer to me then. He was looking at me almost hungrily, as if I were one of his many hunt targets. You were a cynical man, he said. You were loyal, but you never took sides. For you it was simply about the wheels of the machine, and now you are ready to die just to meet me? Have you never considered what is happening to you? Jack had asked me the same thing. For once, I was lost for words. There is a maxim, said Valoris, that you may be familiar with. It states that the Emperor is within all of us, and that all of us are within the Emperor. If you wish to discern his desire, then look to the desire of those who serve. He no longer speaks to us with a mortal voice, but may yet act through the devotion of those who do. This sounded dangerously like heresy. If it had come from any other but him, I might have turned away then. As it was, all I could do was listen. We are not blind to this, he said. When Valerian reported back to me after his meeting with you, I might have summoned you then, but did not, wishing to see how far you were willing to go. That sounds like a cruel game. It was not intended to be. We have learned to be wary, for there are more false prophets than true. But your zeal is unfeigned, for if it had not been, you would be dead already. I cracked a dry smile. Nice to know that, I said. I do not see the way ahead yet, Valoris went on, ignoring me. All paths are dark now, and if I had known the route to take with clarity, it would have been taken 15 years ago. But I cannot ignore what you have done. It may be nothing, just the weakness of an old man, but then again it may be something else. I didn't speak, but then I could hardly believe what I was hearing. So I will take the seat on the council, he said. I will listen to what they have to say, and when it has been considered, I will cast my vote. Consider your task accomplished. For now, I felt a surge of joy well up within me. All we had worked for, week after week of dangerous toil, had paid off, at least for now. I could have no certainty that it would go as intended, but I had the ineffable sense, just as before, of rightness. For the first time in my long career, perhaps ever, I was doing something that I truly believed in. I will ensure all is made ready, Lord, I said, slipping back into my well-trod role as factotum to the powerful. By then, he was already reaching for his helm. His scarred face disappeared behind the mask of gold, ending the brief sense that I had been talking to someone more human than demigod. Then we will speak again, said the Captain General, taking his spear up as if ready to use it. And let us hope your vision does not lead us awry.
Chapter 8. Valerian. I felt many things after that day. Shame, of course, even some degree of anger, but mostly confusion. Heraclian was not given to flights of fancy. Even if I had not been present in his visions, as he believed, I should still have been able to cross the threshold. I was one of the 10,000. That place was my spiritual home, and all of us, to one degree or another, belonged there in the end. After leaving the catacombs, I returned to my duties. I participated in the blood games. I resumed my meditations. I attended the rites of armor, blade, and shield. I completed my study of the philosophy of Ustiandes of Thar, and consigned my monograph to be stored in the archives. And yet the episode nagged at me. My sleep was disturbed. Every time I blinked, it seemed I would see those metaphysical chambers again, the great iron veins, the ancient flesh clinging to the bones of older machines. I felt that my inability to enter must reflect some lack within me. In some way, as yet undetected and undefined, I must have failed. The most immediate consequence of the episode was that I did not even begin preparation for induction into the Hetairan Guard. Heraclian visited me once several days had passed, and held open the possibility of reconsideration. He told me the fault may have been his for misinterpreting the symbols. I appreciated that, but did not believe him. In any event, we agreed that for the time being my duty should remain as it had been, in the outer palace, as one of the many thousands who guarded the walls against the external enemy. Navradaran, too, visited me before his labours took him away again. I was honoured to have had his friendship at that time. Perhaps, looking at us from the outside, you will think our lives somewhat cold and unrelenting, but they are not devoid of the greater human characteristics, and even some of the baser. There were those of my brothers whom I disliked, and those whose fellowship I cherished. Navradaran was one of the latter. I was in the Library of Ancients when he found me. I had been so engrossed in the tome before me that I only heard his distinctive approach from 30 meters away, far less than was required by standard battle readiness. He saw what I was reading, raised an eyebrow, then sat opposite me. All around us, the vast library continued in its ancient rhythms, the shuffle of robes, the tick of iron-tipped fingers, the echoing thud of volumes being replaced on the high shelves.
"The Master of Mankind," Navratilan read softly. "Diocletian Exemplar. You must have read it many times."
"Just once, a long time ago."
"Does it give you answers?"
I slowly turned the great pages, each one a single sheet of thick vellum inscribed in faded inks. This was a copy of a copy of a copy, yet still more than 5,000 years old. "It tells me that our service was not always like this," I said. "We were not always fighting with silence." Navratilan nodded.
"And yet, even then, there was error."
"With greater excuse."
"Was there?"
He smiled faintly. He was older than I was, and had the scars to show it. I did not know how many names he had inscribed on the interior of his armor, but I guessed there were a great number.
"We have become too used to regret, I think," he said. "We have become too used to thinking that the time before was so much greater than our own. And yet, you are reading Diocletian. You can see that even before the failure, there were doubts."
"When I think what has been lost..."
"Then you do not remember what has been gained."
Navratilan placed a heavy gauntlet on the polished wood between us.
"They lived in a time of plenty, and we in a time of strife. Consider how much greater our faith must be compared to theirs."
The words did not bring me much comfort, though neither did I wholly disagree with them. I looked up at him. "I could not pass. I saw what lay within, and I could not pass."
"I know."
"What does it mean?"
"Take it as a sign you are unworthy, and you only harm yourself. We are so ready to believe that we are not good enough."
"Because once we..."
Once, 10,000 years ago, we were faced with an impossible task, and we performed better than any could have ever demanded."
He laughed.
"Do you know, there is some advantage to spending time outside this place. I have met men with no discernible talent who believe themselves kings. I have met the sick who think themselves healthy, the wicked who think themselves righteous. They are so weak, all of them, weak as chaff, yet they do not torture themselves with our doubt. They live, they squabble, they laugh, they blaspheme, and I have come to think that this, somehow, is the greatest sense of all."
I could not help but smile. "You will go back out there, then," I said.
"I find it invigorating."
He looked around him.
"More so than these places."
I could not agree with him then. Here, surrounded by the oldest words, the heavy-set parchments, the theology of the long ages, I felt at my greatest peace. The universe outside was like an inchoate sea, ephemeral and ever-shifting. But in these sights were the eternal verities, warded and preserved forever. There could be no more sacred calling than to keep this safe. "Go in his will, then," I said, reaching to clasp his hand.
"As you, brother,"
he said, returning the gesture.
"And do not read too much."
As it turned out, that did not prove a danger. From that point onwards, I had precious little time for any kind of study. I remembered my meeting with the mortal Tiron. He had been agitated when we had spoken, no doubt with much reason. What I did not appreciate immediately was quite how far that agitation had spread. We, in our privileged echelons, knew of the worsening war at the Cadian Gate. Piece by piece, we became slowly aware of the disaster on the planet of the Wolves. The Captain General was detained much with consideration of both great battle zones, as well as many other older campaigns, and it was said then that he spoke at length with the serving high lords on the provisions made to contain them. The two tribunes were kept informed, and in their own ways made preparation for what might come next. I do not know how word of this spread beyond the walls. We live in a galaxy of uncertain communication, where the screams of a billion voices might disappear into the void, while a single whisper travels securely to its destination. Even the greatest were capable of having their judgment blunted by such extreme variations in transmission failure, and yet I never failed to be astonished at how the rumor of war could spread even among the least educated. Like rats, the populace somehow knew. We did what we could, as the guardians of the species, to ward our charges from hearing harmful tidings, but our efforts failed more often than not. Of course, it was certain that the enemy had a hand in such dissemination. We were not so blind that we discounted the presence of seditious cells on Terra. However many inquisitors we deployed, though, and however many pyres they constructed, there were always more traitors waiting to take their place. For all Navradaran admired the mortal human spirit, it was also capable of truly pathetic weakness. And so, almost as soon as we knew it ourselves, word of the worsening state of the war began to filter, by some strange process of osmosis, into the slums and the hive towers. The enforcers were soon run ragged, trying to keep up with it. We received tidings of more rioting across the southern hemispheric zones, fueled by both panic and long-stoked resentments. The downtrodden impoverished could put up with much if they believed that the Imperium could at least keep them safe. Once they lost that sense, our grip on their loyalty was loosened. My first direct experience of this came 2 days after Navradaran had left the palace. Tribune Italia requested my presence at the southeastern wall zones, following entreaties made to him by the regular garrison commanders. These were the outer palace walls, you understand, running around the gigantic estates for hundreds of kilometers. Even if all 10,000 of my brothers had patrolled those walls, there would still have been gaping swathes of emptiness, and so, instead, many regiments of psycho-conditioned mortal soldiers were used to bolster our limited numbers. Some were drawn from regiments famed in the outside Imperium, such as the Lucifer Blacks, while others were virtually unknown outside Terra, like the white-robed Palatine Sentinels. I answered the call, and was met at the landing site by the captain of the 156th Regiment, the Tramon Standards, a man with a name badge reading Leovine Werish. We arranged our rendezvous just inside the vast concave sweep of the curtain wall, the wide landing site falling under its shadow as the sun struggled to climb over the eastern horizon. Above us, the grey screen of Terra's unquiet skies churned away, and hot ash wind danced around us. He did his best not to be daunted by my presence. Even for those who served within the sacred confines of the palace, though, we were a rare and imposing sight. "My Lord Custodian," he said, kneeling. When he rose again, I could see how drawn his face was. He had the kind of fatigue that only comes from long periods of near-constant action without respite, the kind that gets into the bones and never loosens its bite. "They tell me you are having trouble, Captain," I said. "I don't know where it all comes from," he said, too tired to make any attempt to hide the scale of the problem. In fact, I could hear the size of it for myself, a dull rolling roar from the far side of the massive walls, the telltale sound of thousands of voices raised in anger. "There's a madness out there." "You have done your best, I'm sure." He looked hollowed out. "I'm glad you're with us, Lord. Will the rest of your detachment be here soon?" If I smiled at that, he would not have seen it, for I was wearing my full panoply of war, and my face was enclosed in gold. There was no detachment. It was unusual for us even to consider deploying as a detachment. My chamber would come with me when they were called, but the need for that was rare, and I would only consider summoning them in the utmost extremity. He could not possibly know that, though. Perhaps he had served with the Angels of Death in some other war zone, and had seen how they used their bonds of brotherhood to multiply their unique prowess, and it was logical enough for him to assume that we operated in the same fashion. "Let us see this, then," was all I said. He bowed hastily, signaled his departure to an escort of 30 equally weary staff officers, and the two of us moved to where my Talian Gravlander was waiting on the apron. I took the pilot's seat, and Werish strapped himself into the counterpart, looking ludicrously small among restraint strappings designed for one of my kind. We lifted off and headed for an egress gate built into the wall structure. For a little while, all we had ahead of us was the gently curving slope of pure black adamantium. Steps were carved every 200 meters, zigzagging up the windswept face towards the walkway at the top, 30 meters across and overshadowed by a high, embattled parapet. Defense towers loomed at 100-meter intervals, massive gun citadels crowned with las cannons and heavy bolters, all angled outwards into the cityscape beyond. Then the egress gate opened, twin blast doors sliding apart to reveal the glowing red innards of the wall itself. We passed within, and saw the racks of attack craft hanging from launch cages within the dimly lit interior, then the ammunition trains for the towers above, then the strobing power beams for the void shielding. The wall here was less of a solid barrier than an incredibly large contiguous fortress, one that was garrisoned and active and home to hundreds of thousands. The gate opened on the far side, and the Talian emerged into the dull grey of the Terran dawn. The landscape beyond the walls was open, scoured of the usual hard press of hab towers and hive spires by ancient ordinances prohibiting building right up to the ancient wall line. In that rarest of things on this world, open space, thousands of people had gathered. They were chanting something in semi-unison, mobbing the walls in stages before falling back. I could see Werish's troops down among them, holding the tide back in thin lines of pale grey. There was no risk of such a rabble penetrating the walls themselves. The danger was that they would overrun the urban zone leading back from the perimeter, triggering a degradation of the secure cordon and making clearance operations necessary. Even from the flyer's closed cockpit, I could taste mania in the air, a stench that rose higher than the fervid chants. The sky above us was, as ever, filled with aircraft, adding their own contrails to the film of soot that hung over us. I could see our Beatty's scrutiny landers among them, hovering watchfully. Beyond the disturbance rose the behemoths of the Eternal City, a jungle of both squalor and magnificence. Glancing ahead at it, I suddenly had a vision of dry tinder, heaps of it, piled up against the foundations of our walls, ready for the spark. "That crowd is preparing to charge your men," I observed, noting a basic swarm pattern developing amid the mobs. Werish nodded wearily. "I'll order another volley. We have air support now." He had ordered his forces logically. They were spread out in a long, ragged line against the base of the wall, with reserve units dug in on either flank. They looked to be equipped with lasguns for the most part, and evidence of their use was everywhere. A tide mark of bodies where the crowd had last pushed up against them. I brought the lander down towards ground level. I could see the leaders of the rabble now, stirring the crowds up to charge at the hated bringers of discipline. Some of the mob were carrying burning braziers, others power staves that snapped with faint curls of plasma. One of them was wearing pale blue robes, streaked with dust and dirt. His eyes were blank, like pearls, and his bald pate had a false third eye daubed across it. Things were escalating. The throngs were furious, and a great many of their number had already been shot. I estimated perhaps 8,000 were present, versus a few hundred of Werish's soldiers. Most of the front rank rioters would die in a rush, but a lasgun could only down so many before its bearer was overwhelmed. The senselessness of it saddened me. Those gathered there could have had no true idea what they were rioting about. Their latent rage and fear had been whipped up by more cynical souls. The chants rose in volume. The braziers spat with dirty flame. The skies above us ran with the faint crackle of lightning, lancing from the turning gyre over the Sanctum Imperialis. It was all ready to explode. "Do not fire," I told Werish, bringing the flyer ever lower and making the dust skitter in the downdraft. "Kill these thousands today, and there will be tens of thousands tomorrow. Tell your troops to hold position." I set the flyer's machine spirit to override, opened the cockpit blister, pulled free of the seat, and leapt earthwards. We were only a matter of meters from the ground by then. I dropped to one knee on impact, then rose up smoothly and began to walk. I was surrounded on every side. For a few moments, I went unimpeded. The closest of the mortals stared at me, open-mouthed. Then the more perspicacious, recognizing slowly what I was, started to shout in alarm, then to run, to fall on their faces, to stumble and panic. More turned and fled, shoving their way through the rest to get away. The vast crowd began to fold in on itself, suddenly riven by inexplicable terror at its heart. I paid them no attention. They were like a swarm of insects, huge, but incapable of doing me harm. Many were not even properly armed, just carrying machine tools or improvised spears, and their screaming turned swiftly from anger to terror. Some even cried out words of desperate repentance, sobbing frantically and trying to touch my cloak, though the bulk of them merely wished to get away from me as fast as they could. I knew the Angels of Death had an expression for this phenomenon. Transhuman dread, they called it. If anything, our order possessed the greater power in that regard, amplified by our stature, our rarity, the esoteric imagery of our golden armor. I could have killed so many of them then, if I'd wanted to. I could have waded into those reeling ranks and handed down the judgment of the Emperor until the many thousands were all broken at my feet. I did none of those things. Killing is easy. Our Imperium has stagnated in many ways, and yet we have become such experts in the application of violence that to end a life has become as trivial and as commonplace as clearing a throat. I had no compunction over using my power when it was necessary, but neither did I share the zeal for destruction that so many of the throne's own servants exhibited. If it had been possible to solve our many problems through the continual application of unrestrained force, then you would have thought that over 10,000 years of trying it, we might have had some rather better outcomes. I reached the location of the one who controlled them, the man with the eye mark. His bodyguards fell away from him as I approached, scrambling to get clear. One of them choked on his fear, others voided their bladders even as they ran. The man himself was shaking, barely able to remain in position to face me, his face convulsing jerkily with an attempt at defiance. He carried some kind of staff bedecked with feathers. I had no idea where he might have obtained feathers. Real ones were not generally to be found in the slums of Terra.
"Here to kill me, then, Golden One!"
the man cried, and his strained voice gave away his crippling terror. It would have been the work of but a moment. "Why are you doing this?" I asked quietly. He could barely meet my gaze. His skin was glossy with sweat.
"The end is coming for you,"
he blurted, wild-eyed now.
"I have been shown it."
"Why are you doing this?" I asked again, with just the same inflection. He started to lose his last slivers of self-command.
"Because you can't protect us," he hissed. "They'll sweep you away. They'll sweep it all away."
His eyes lost focus.
"What did he tell me? The path. It is opening now."
I was aware of 100 things around me. Men and women were running, surging around us, trying to get back into the hab zones. The braziers had toppled. The flyers still hovered, their guns trained but silent. The entire offensive had dissolved into panicked retreat, testament both to its fragility and to the residual authority of the throne.
"The gate has already fallen,"
he went on, raving now in both fear and excitement.
You know that? Has he got back to your deaf and blind masters yet?
Who told you these things? I asked. He started to laugh, and the sound had an edge of frenzy to it.
What does it matter to you? You are deaf to those voices. You are deaf to all living voices. The dead cannot stand against the living. You hear me? The dead cannot stand against the living.
The two of us were like a small island of stability amid a world of motion. This amateur assault was over, but that meant little in the wider scheme of things. More mobs would come, larger ones, stirred up by madness such as this, and there were not enough of us to break them all. We needed to discover more of their origin. Come with me, I said. He stared at me, horrified.
No,
he said, in a smaller voice. You have committed great sins. I never lifted my voice above a murmur, but he lost what little composure he'd had then. Tears started in his eyes.
I have, though,
he confessed, wonderingly, as if only just seeing it.
I have committed great sins.
There are ways to atone for them, I said. He took a faltering step towards me, blinking, staring.
Oh, by the throne, he mumbled, dispirited. But all these things are ended.
I summoned the flyer, and a moment later heard its engines overhead. Werish was still on board, and looked startled to see me conversing with the heretic. I gestured towards the open cockpit door. Meekly, haltingly, the man let his staff fall from his hands, then made his way to the compartment at the rear, moving as if in a stupor. I sealed the door behind him, then went back to Werish. "The machine spirit will take you back," I said. "Deliver him to the Ordo Hereticus Watch Division in your sector. Explain the manner of his capture. Tell them I wish to study their report on him when it is done." Werish nodded. His eyes flickered to the retreating crowds, still out in the open, all within range of his guns.
"And the rest?" he asked.
I followed his gaze. I could see them scampering, stumbling, their eyes wide with fear. According to the Lex Imperialis, all of them were traitors.
"Let them go." "Their executions are warranted," he ventured carefully.
"They were fools and weaklings," I said. "Do not become too fond of killing such, Captain." Then I flicked a finger, and the flyer rose up, twisting on a column of superheated air, before heading back towards the still open egress gate, taking Werish and the weeping heretic with it. I turned back towards the Eternal City, a place I had barely ventured into since my ascension. I could not quite believe how dirty it was up close. It smelt of confinement. They were still running from me. I remembered Navradaran's words.
"There is some advantage to spending time outside this place."
Then I looked back over my shoulder at the wall, soaring high above even the greatest of the city's towers. Its outer surface, dark as jet, was still scored with antiquated wounds. Even the newest sections were almost 9,000 years old. Some parts were as old as the Imperium itself. They looked utterly indomitable, the kind of barrier that armies would shatter against for eternity. I could just make out the greatest of the structures housed within. The Sanctum Imperialis itself, the apex of our entire existence, was like a distant mountain, hazy with mist. The Tower of Heroes was a slender vertical line of grey against a stormy horizon. It is a curious thing to witness one's home from the outside, to see it as they did. I had always supposed that they must have felt excluded, the masses of terror, shut out from the magnificence and forever scratching up against closed doors, like famished waifs. But just then, I suddenly saw it in a different aspect. They had been terrified of me. I was the closest living embodiment of the Emperor's soul, and they had run from me, screaming. Perhaps they saw the walls not as the barrier that kept them from getting into the palace, but the barrier that kept us from getting out. Perhaps they saw it not as an impediment to their movement, but as our necessary cage. I could see that now. I could see the high walls and the age-darkened towers, and it looked like nothing quite so much as a prison, vast and old, sealing its terrible heart closed like layers of rockcrete thrown up over a lethal reactor. I had to go back inside. My duties were many, and already I could detect mind-impulse queries and commands from the Tower of Hegemon. When I turned to walk back, though, my boots felt heavy, as if I were walking through sand. The sense was easy to shake off, and I started to move, but I had felt it all the same.
Chapter 9. Alea. I had never known the warp like it. Travel had always been difficult between the stars, and over the past few years I had been told many times by many different navigators that it had been getting steadily worse. Most of the things they told me about, the ether eddies and the surge tunnels, made no sense at all to me, but I could certainly feel the hammering our vessels took as they rattled through the Empyrean. On previous journeys, I had often wondered what would have happened if I'd lifted the warp shutters and gazed at it, like the navigators do. A normal human would have been driven mad in seconds, they said. But then normal humans had souls, and thus the psychic realm was intelligible to them. What would I see? Nothing. Legions of demons. The true essence of the warp itself. I'd never been sufficiently curious to find out. The chances were that the sight would have been fatal to me in one way or another. Pariah or not, the Empyrean was no place to linger in or gaze upon, not if you wanted to keep your sanity. Now, though, I was half tempted again. The decks of the Kadamara were like drumskins, resonating in a way that put my teeth on edge. We'd already lost one of our secondary drivetrains, dropping our speed through the galactic mire and amplifying every crash and slew that the unquiet abyss imposed on us. I staggered down teetering corridors, feeling queasy from the weeks-long incessant movement. There was some irony to that. I spent most of my time making others nauseous, and now had some sympathy for how that felt. My sense of dislocation had another cause. For a while after returning to the ship, I had refused to mourn, preferring to channel my energy into activity. As the strange days and the ether had lengthened, though, my thoughts had turned increasingly to what had been lost. I had loved my sisters. It was a fierce, almost desperate kind of love, born of the fact that we shared such a unique bond. All of us could remember the time when we had been dragged into the convent, filthy and starving, more used to blows than words of explanation, and then slowly realized that this place was safe, and that it had been made for us, and that we were not alone in the universe. It was not a comfortable existence. We were trained, sometimes brutally. Hestia was not motivated by any benevolent sense of care, but by a pitiless vocation rooted in ancient doctrine. Some who found their way into the convent died soon afterwards, at times from exhaustion, at times by taking their own life. Those who survived became stronger in both body and mind. We learned secrets about the universe, ones that would have been our death sentence if ever uttered outside the walls of that place. Before we took our vow of tranquility, we spoke and chattered and gossiped, just as all juveniles did. We even laughed whenever our regulated days would allow, sharing private jests about our humorless instructors. Even once the time for spoken words had passed, we still shared those bonds. Thoughtmark, in its fullest form, was an expressive language, in some ways more so than standard speech, and the friendships I made were all the stronger for the adversity in which they had been forged. Now I could only recall their faces. Erin, Katali, Ruja, bloodied by their untimely deaths. The memory of that was like a wound, gaping and blood raw, taking me right back to my earliest days as a hunted infant, unable to understand why the whole world seemed intent on causing me harm. I could share that grief with no one. I was as alone as I had ever been, surrounded only by the besold, who could never understand that it is hard for our kind to be isolated. We have less to draw on internally than others, and the great irony of our self-imposed seclusion is that we need human fellowship more, for it temporarily fills the void lurking within our own hearts. I began to dread what I would find when we finally arrived at the throne world. I was under no illusions that the journey would be easy, or even that we would make it at all. Hestia had once told me that the pilgrim route was only for the deluded, and that the chances of reaching Holy Terra, as an individual, were tiny. Now that the High Lord seemingly wished to forget all about the Sisterhood of Silence, how I hated that name, we could be sure of no special treatment to ease our passage. But I pushed the ship onwards, keeping it at the limit of its power, ignoring the warnings of Slovo and his acolytes to respect the turbulence of the warp. In my mind, the three things were surely linked. The old legions making their return, the targeting of the convent, the gathering storm in the ether. You did not need to be a seer to realize that some new alignment was in progress, and that we had struggled on for too long with the old ways, when their efficacy had long since ceased. I subsumed everything else to this new goal. I took my grief, and I made it into a weapon, just as we had been trained to do. If I had to break the Kadamara apart to do it, I would still make it to the golden spires of the shrine world and discover just what Locke had seen before he died. Perhaps I should have listened to Slovo's warnings, but then temperance had never been my strong point, and, as Hestia had always told me, there is greater power in righteous wrath than in meek acceptance. I staggered. Something had hit us hard. That, I thought, was impossible. We were deep in the warp, and there were no physical objects to hit. Then I saw the alert rune and started to run. I was in my armor, as we all were. Void passage was so perilous now that I had instructed the crew to remain battle-prepared at all times. We were hit again. It felt like some enormous closed fist had rammed us amidships, sending the ship swinging round its center of gravity. As I closed in on Slovo's sanctum, high up in the spine of the ship, I heard the screams. His chambers were entirely sealed off from the main structure during warp passage, the better to insulate him during the arduous process of guidance. I reached the first of the heavy doors and punched the access codes hurriedly. All the while I could hear booms shuddering down the superstructure, loud and getting louder. The doors heaved open, and I smelt the stale air of the sanctum's interior as it washed over me. The lumens were erratic, blinking across dirty bulkheads. I plunged inside and saw a pair of acolytes holding their temples and weeping what looked like blood. They were menials from House Rahata, ungifted with the seeing eye, and they were wailing like slaughtered porcines. I heard Slovo crying out from further inside. The chambers were low-roofed and braced with heavy bands of adamantium. The whole place looked like a military bunker, solid and unbreakable. But it was breaking now. Cracks had already shot up the inner walls, shivering with released energy. I ran through the maze to Slovo's inner domain, a sphere of iron lodged within the ship's hull, accessible only by a single metal gantry over a moat of oil. As I crossed, I could see more breaches, popping with lightning that curled and danced across the void. As I neared the portal, it blew open, sending a cloud of noxious gas boiling out at me. Slovo himself staggered into view, his skin wet with whatever fluids he'd immersed himself in, cables still trailing from intravenous lines in his arms. "Get us out!" he gasped, his mortal eyes staring and bloodshot. Thankfully, he'd managed to wrap up his deadly seeing eye, though the rest of his robes were only loosely hanging from his scrawny body. "Get us out!" I punched the runes through to Erefan. Immediate crash out of warp. and moved to help Slovo. He pushed me away, teetering on the gantry's railing. He was wild, barely seeing what was around him, and he too had lines of blood running from his nostrils.
"They're getting in," he hissed, drooling. "The field's breaking down. Get us out!"
Looking over his reeling shoulder, I could just make out the disarray in the sphere. The nutrient tank he floated in was filthy and leaking, and the cables hanging like spiders' limbs from the roof were sending spears of electricity scattering across the interior. I grabbed him by the shoulder and hauled him away from it, backing up along the gantry. I could already hear the alert klaxons as Erefan did as he was asked. The ship shook wildly, blowing more lumens, then seemed to drop vertiginously, as if falling through a place where gravity still existed. I gestured furiously at him. What happened? But he was blind to me. Then I saw something move out of the corner of my eye. More lights shattered, plunging the space into flickering shadow. It looked, but this was impossible, as if the walls were draining down like viscous fluid, sliding off the ship's substructure, and pooling into a slough of molten steel. I dragged Slovo the rest of the way, back to the blast doors and into the warren of chambers beyond. He clawed at me, jabbering something about the impossibility of a Geller field losing integrity, and just what took place if that happened, and how they were coming, and they were getting inside, and they knew who we were, and where we were going. My heart was thumping hard. There were noises echoing up from the bilges below us, distorted and shrieking. For a moment I thought this might be what the warp itself sounded like. Some terrible snapshot into an infinity of agonized souls, before the Kadamara bucked again, thrown away from its ventral axis. Inner panels punched inwards, power lines exploded, armor glass suddenly frosted with impact patterns. I heard fresh alarms going off, and a status panel above me flashed runes, indicating we were tumbling back into real space. We reached the room with the menials in it. One was slumped on the deck face down, a pool of blood slowly forming under her face. The other, a male, was still on his feet, twitching madly against the far wall, as if impaled on it. The vibrations from the hull were dying down now, and the worst of the lurching subsided, but we remained in a whirling lumen pattern of intermittent darkness. I could barely see anything with clarity. Freeze-frame images of blood and terror jumped around before me.
"Are we out?"
hissed Slovo, clutching at my cloak. I didn't answer. I pushed him away from me and reached for my flamer. The standing menial was grinning at me. He was grinning so wide that it tore the edges of his mouth. Every flash of swaying light made that grin bigger and darker, and as I watched, he reached up to his mouth, pushed a hand inside, grabbed his tongue, and began to pull. I slipped my hand over the trigger. Something long and black and glistening came out of his mouth and just kept coming. I opened the flamer. I saw the man scream and writhe within the shaking torrent of extreme heat. His robes ignited in a burst, his skin crisped to black, but I kept up the roaring inferno. I saw something slimy and oil dark curl up amid the flames, coiling for the strike. I heard fractured screaming, as if from many places at once, none of them here. I reached for my sword, just as it leapt for me, a mass of prehensile limbs and wicked spines. I lashed out, severing one of the tentacles, then spun around to plunge my blade into the polyp of flesh at its heart. It shrieked and clutched at me, trying to smother me in waves of sinuous gristle, but by then I was in combat trance, beyond mortal senses, moving faster and harder and working my blade in a whirl of pressed steel. This was Shedim. That should have been impossible, given our Geller Aegis, but it was here, on the ship. I could smell its stink, the rotting of the human flesh it had taken for its own, pulled apart and remade. I carved it open. It lashed at me, trying to drag me down, but by then I was a tongue of flame, a howl of the world's wind. My sword gyrated, and slops of its unnatural body thudded to the deck, still jerking.
"Anathema, Psychana,"
it whispered to me, rearing up in obscene mockery of physical law, growing into a tentacled slab of muscle and mucus. I saw its hundreds of eyes stare at me, hundreds of identical human eyes copied from its host, replete with lids and lashes and tears. Its mouth had never stopped growing, and it was now a huge and ragged maw, lined with teeth, flapping and saliva-flecked.
"Alone, alone out here, I will relish turning you inside out."
I never listened. A mortal had to struggle not to listen to the Shedim, but not me. This thing was an unbearable horror to a mortal, a temptation beyond endurance, but for me, it was merely disgusting and dangerous, like a snake found under a pillow, something to stamp on. I plunged my blade into its mouth and snickered it across those teeth, yanking them out of black gums. I danced harder, ducking under the flail of tentacles and severing those that came close. I felt its sting on my armor, the sucking pull of warp-spun strands, and slashed myself free. The thing had a heart, it had lungs, and it had organs, all pulled out of shape from its host, but still necessary for it in this place. I delved to find them, cutting like a surgeon. When I reached my target, the blade drove in deep, sending a jet of ink-black blood fountaining over both of us. I cut and I cut, wading into the belly of the creature to sever its essence before it could regenerate more. It screamed all the while until I sawed out its swollen lungs, grabbing the sacks of pus and foul gas and hurling them messily to the deck. I ripped its gullet from its throat and burst its flaccid stomach with a stamp of my boot. And that finally shut it up. Then the rest of it exploded, blown apart by the violence of my assault, flying into scraps of torn fat and spittle. My armor was coated in it, my sword sopping, my loose hair caked. I endured the deluge, waiting for the rain of slops to subside. The chamber was rancid now. The corpse of the second menial was almost lost under a pile of steaming viscera. Slovo cowered in the corner, scratching at the closed door, his eyes still staring in the stop-start lumen glare. I had to be sure. I rooted through the remnants of the kill, blade at the ready. They were vicious things, always, and could revive after cursorily lethal amounts of punishment if you were unwary. The main lumens came back on, stronger this time. I heard the rapid clatter of boots from the corridors outside and guessed that Erephon had stabilized the ship and sent a security detail to aid me. "A bit late," I thought, "but at least we're fully into real space." I turned to face Slovo. I must have looked half demonic myself, caked in a skin of black, inky blood and scales. He was in bad shape, but I was in no mood to go easy on him. "Answers," I signed, and I truly think that command was the thing that scared him most of all. Perhaps I should have been more sympathetic. Even for a navigator, one who stares into the abyss as a vocation, it is very hard to look upon a true instantiated Shedim. Up close, they are the weft of nightmares, and they send the mortal mind into paroxysm. The rest of the crew were little better. Erephan's details skidded into the chamber with their guns drawn and were soon gagging and vomiting and trying to keep their bowels under control. They weren't particularly cowardly or foolish. They were just human, and so weren't designed to be confronted by a denizen of the undiluted ether. I understood, too, that we were all of us seeing very different things. I experienced the Shedim, the demon, in its corporeal aspect only. The matter it had taken and reshaped from the unfortunate acolyte and turned into its new body. That was horrific enough, in a biological kind of way. but it didn't possess any further terror for one of my experience. The Besold, on the other hand, could perceive its psychic aspect too, and that, I was told, was where the true fear lay. Even the smell of it could evoke that crushing sense of nausea and dread that made them lose their minds and surrender control over their bodies, and the sight was 10 times worse. Humans found so very much in the galaxy uniquely repulsive. The pariah and demon and the xenos. I sometimes wondered how the fragile creatures ever lived long enough to breed. I ordered the soldiers out, and they were just about able to understand battle sign enough to comply. Then I wiped the ichor from my helm and dropped down to look at Slovo. He was coming round. I guessed that being ripped from the warp trance made it doubly difficult, but I needed to know what was going on. "Clean yourself," I signed to him again. 5 minutes. I pulled him to his feet and helped him walk out of there. I sealed the doors behind us, handed him over to his own surviving house menials, and went to find a hose. 5 minutes later, I was sitting opposite him in one of the ship's lead-lined interrogation chambers, with Erifan present too. The three of us sat around a bolted-down table and tried to ignore the stench emanating from two of us.
"I couldn't believe it," Slovo started, his eyes flickering between Erifan and me. He had calmed down a lot, but was still febrile. "I don't even know how to describe it."
"Try, please," said Erifan sourly. The captain had done well to bring us out of the warp so quickly, without scattering the hull across a swath of space-time. But he wasn't happy that he'd had to. Slovo drew in a miserable breath.
"The warp's growing," he said.
I didn't understand how that could be possible. The warp, I had always been told, was a mirror of reality. The one was the size of the other.
"Very, very bad," Slovo went on. "Was watching it happen, tearing space like a sheet of paper. We were heading right down the fault line. It blew the outer aegis. I could hear them. Throne, I could hear them."
"Can't you always hear them?" asked Erifan.
"Not like this."
Slovo looked up at me.
"They knew you were here. They were smashing up against the hull to get to you. There were hundreds of them."
He shook his head.
"We had to drop out of it. I don't know how long we had. A few seconds more."
"But one got through," I signed.
"Just as we dropped to real space," Slovo nodded. "Must have done it then. Caught on the wrong side, and it was weak by then."
Erifan turned to me. "The Geller array's in a bad state," he said. "We have a lot of burned-out relays. It'll take a while to repower it." It would have been good to have been able to use Thoughtmark then, to ask the kind of subtle questions I needed to ask. I wanted to know more about what was going on.
"It's like a rift,"
Slovo said, his voice full of foreboding.
"A crack. A canyon. It's growing."
"I don't know what that means," said Erifan. Slovo barked a hoarse laugh.
"I don't know either, Captain. I'm trying to make sense of what I saw."
He pressed his hands together, trying to stop them shaking.
"Felt as if the whole galaxy were breaking apart down the middle. I saw the edge of it, dropping into a deeper void. I saw the light running out of the universe, leaking out of it."
I leaned forwards. "The beacon," I signed.
"The Astronomicon? It's damned faint, damned faint. We lost it for a while back there, but I could just about lock on before the Aegis started to crack."
I felt impatience growing. Slovo was in shock, that was clear, but I had little patience for his weakness. He had a task, and I needed him to fulfill it. I turned to Erefan. How long? I signed. I can get the warp drives back online in a few hours. We've taken some hull damage, but nothing the servitors can't patch. It's the Geller field that worries me.
We can't go back in there, said Slovo vehemently. They'll tear us apart. They know you're here, and they hate you.
I remembered the star map, with its lines of snaking warp channels. It felt then as if the universe were falling into some long-arranged configuration, its tectonic plates shifting, and we were caught in the heart of it.
And they know what we're doing, Slovo went on, rambling now. They know where we're going, and they'll break us open to prevent it.
I could have silenced him. Some battle sign gestures were physically painful for an untrained recipient, and I could have gummed those lips together easily. But I thought it best to let him get it out of his system.
I think it's the gate, he said,
his eyes flickering from Erefan to me and back again.
I think something's broken and the balance has gone. We can't go back in there.
I turned to Erefan. 4 hours, I signed.
I can do it in 5, he replied.
4,
I told him. Then I got up. I needed to clean myself properly, wipe the stench of demon from my armor, and boil wash my hair. Then I needed to refuel the flamer, attend to my blades, and begin the process of drilling the crew. We would have to barricade the most vulnerable sections, the navigator's blister, the command bridge, the exposed engineering chambers. The Kadamara had a standing garrison of a few hundred, and if they were prepared for combat, they might be able to hold their ground for long enough for me to do what was necessary. I was sure Slovo was right. I was sure that the Empyrean was rupturing, and that the inhabitants of the warp would be on to us as soon as we cleared the veil again, and that the chances of us emerging unscathed was zero. But if his visions were correct, then this growing rift risked stranding us forever in the void, or at least on the wrong side of where we needed to be. So we would do it. We would fight our way through. The navigator was looking at me, appalled. At least he wasn't talking anymore. Erefan was a professional and kept his feelings to himself. I had no idea whether it would be possible to get us back on course within 4 hours, but at least he had something to work towards now. I left them in the chamber and walked briskly to my own. I could worry about the navigator's state of mind later, when crossing the veil was a possibility again. For now, though, I had a defense scheme to plan.
Chapter 10. Tyran.
And so we come to the heart of the matter, said the master of the Administratum, Urthu Himatalian. He sat at the head of the long black granite table, his grey face a picture of studied mournfulness. He was wearing his heavy ceremonial robes, just as all the other High Lords did, though his were perhaps the most ostentatious, as befitted his role as first among equals. It hadn't always been thus.